One of the things I learned in the House of Representatives was never go into the well to give a speech after Jim Wright. And you just saw the reason for that. Let me say how greatly pleased I am to be at TCU and to be in your company. I've heard all of my life about Texas Christian University from Jim and from others, and this is my first visit. And I want to say how much I have appreciated the very warm hospitality that has been extended to me. And I want you to know what an exceptional public servant Jim Wright has been. One of these days, I'm going to get around to establishing a Hall of Fame for public servants. I don't see why we shouldn't have one. We have one for baseball players and guitar players. We surely ought to have one for public servants. And I can absolutely guarantee you that on the first ballot, Jim Wright will go into that Hall of Fame. I look back on the number of members of Congress that I thought were just superb stump speakers. I think there were probably three or four, but Jim Wright was among them. I think he was the most eloquent, extemporaneous speaker that I have ever heard. And you saw a sample of it a moment ago. I am here tonight because of Jim Wright and my great affection and admiration for him and for Betty and for the extraordinary public service that he has given to this nation. Jim, it is a very high honor for me to be with you. We had a Speaker of the House some years ago, not Jim Wright, but another one. A gentleman from Massachusetts, John McCormick. And John McCormick was a great debater. And he would sit up on that rostrum and decide that he wanted to get into the debate. And he'd come down, as we said, into the well of the House. Someone on the other side of the aisle would invariably irritate him. And he would turn to that person and say, "I hold the gentleman from Iowa in minimum high regard." I want you to know, because you are friends and supporters of TCU, I hold you in maximum high regard. Delighted to be here. Jim and I had a lot of fun in the United States Congress, and one of the things I did was collect some of the sayings I heard members of Congress give from the floor. My all-time favorite bumper sticker was the bumper sticker that Father Drinan, he was a Catholic priest. I don't think a Catholic priest can be elected to Congress anymore, but he was elected some years ago, and he had a bumper sticker that said, "Vote for Father Drinan or go to hell." Now, neither Jim nor I had that kind of courage. I used to spend a good part of my life debating the Middle East. Seemed to me we used to debate it every couple of weeks in the Congress. And one time I was sitting on the floor and a colleague got up and he said, right in the middle of the debate, "I don't see why the Arabs and the Israelis cannot settle this thing just like good Christians ought to." If Abraham Lincoln were alive today, he'd be turning over in his grave. That's another one. We had a debate on trade one time, and a fella got up, he got his metaphors mixed up. "If we don't stop shearing the sheep that lays the golden egg, we'll pump it dry," he said. I was never quite sure of this next story, but it's a good story, so I'll tell it anyway. One congressman bet another one $5 that he could not repeat the Lord's Prayer. The other congressman said he could. And he began to recite, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep." The other congressman handed him $5 and said, "I never thought you could have done it." I was talking to Tim Russert the other night. He's got a great baseball story. The Yankees were playing the White Sox. Some of you baseball fans can remember these names. Whitey Ford was pitching. Yogi Berra was the catcher. First White Sox batter comes up, hits a sharp single on the first pitch. Second batter comes up on the first pitch, hits a single. Runners on first and second. Third batter comes up, hits another single on the first pitch. You got the bases loaded. Fourth batter comes up, first pitch, home run. Casey Stengel comes tearing out of the dugout, comes up to Yogi Berra. He says, "What's the matter? Has Whitey Ford lost his stuff?" And Yogi Berra says, "How the hell would I know? I haven't caught a ball yet." Well, I probably better get to the topic of the evening here. Jim's beginning to get a little nervous down there. I don't know if Jim remembers, but President Bush, 41, came to Capitol Hill and on St. Patrick's Day, and he was talking to members of Congress, and he said there are two things that all of us should do on St. Patrick's Day. Talking to members of Congress, one is to visit saints, and the other is to visit scholars. And he says, "What that means is I've got two more stops to make today." Okay, let's get a little more serious here, and we'll talk about American foreign policy for a few minutes. I begin with what we'd all agree to, and that is that America is the world's most powerful nation. We're the strongest nation in the world militarily. We've got the largest economy, we've got the highest level of technological achievement, we've got the most extensive cultural influence in all the world. We've got center stage all to ourselves. We are, and we will remain, after Iraq, the world's preeminent power. Our military is in over 140 countries in the world. English is the language of the world, isn't it? You can see American movies and television in the remotest regions of Africa. Our inventions have revolutionized human life. But our power is not infinite. We cannot police the world. We cannot set global economic and trade policies by ourselves. We cannot kill every terrorist. We cannot throw over every evil regime. We cannot make the world in our image. And it is this contradiction, if you will, awesome power on the one hand, and our inability to bend the world to our will on the other, that confronts us, and I guess at times frustrates us. So how do we deal with that kind of a situation? I know that Iraq kind of sucks the oxygen out of all of the discussions today, but I want to put that aside and think a little longer term, if I may. How do we achieve our interests in this kind of a world? About 6 years ago, we had an awful event in this country, 9/11. President Bush spoke after that, and in a few speeches over a period of time, he set forth some astonishing goals for the United States. I'm going to paraphrase him here for a moment or two. We would defeat terrorists and states that sponsor terrorism. We would defeat rogue regimes who seek weapons of mass destruction. We would ensure that no competitor to U.S. hegemony emerges. We would abandon our support for stability in the Middle East in favor of democratic transformation. And we would spread democracy around the world. And he began to apply American power robustly. We invaded Afghanistan and started nation building in that country. We identified North Korea and Iran, and of course Iraq, as part of the axis of evil. We embraced a doctrine of preemptive strikes against threats before they are fully formed. We, of course, invaded Iraq. We relied less on traditional alliances like NATO, turning instead to ad hoc coalitions of the willing. And then Saddam Hussein fell. It's kind of hard now in 2007 to think back to the very heady days that gripped Washington in this country in 2002 and 2003. Many of my friends in Washington at that time spoke openly about an American empire. There was talk of transforming the world in the image of America. But now, as we look around us, we see the limitations of American power. In Iraq, you don't need to be told about that. Tragic country. In Pakistan, we heard the other day in a national intelligence estimate that Al-Qaeda is as strong today as it was 6 years ago. If in Afghanistan, the Taliban is resurgent, the opium trade has overwhelmed the economy, and American and NATO casualties are rising. In Iran, where one of our scholars at the Woodrow Wilson Center where I work was just held for 105 days, the president of that country has come to power. He's meddled in Iraq. He's continued Iran's nuclear program despite our demands. In Lebanon, Hezbollah defied Israel and the United States. The drive to transplant democracy to the Arab and the Muslim worlds has stalled. Russia is awash with petrodollars, and Putin is saying that the United States has acted illegitimately and illegally. Those are his words, and he has compared the United States to the Third Reich of Germany many years ago. In Latin America, Hugo Chavez is rising, and in Cuba, an ailing Fidel Castro maintains power, and in Darfur, international outrage has failed to stop genocidal violence, and around the world, alarms are ringing about climate change. And whereas our ability to accomplish things in the world seemed unlimited in 2002 and 2003, we now begin to see that many of these problems may outpace our ability to confront them and certainly to solve them. In the past, the success of American foreign policy has been that we pursued our own national interest, of course, but as we did so, other nations benefited from our leadership. If you look back to what I consider to be the great period of American diplomacy right after World War II, when America then was a preeminent power, but we used our diplomacy in such a way that we advanced not only our interests, but we persuaded other nations around the world that what we favored and what we did was in their interest as well. And I think in many ways we have to get back to that. We sit today at the top of the world in many respects. But there are also a lot of questions around the world about our leadership. There are serious questions about that leadership. Now, let me make clear, I do not accept or agree with the view that America has somehow entered into a permanent state of decline. I don't buy that for a moment. But America's power today is diminished. And others see us as a great power, but one whose military limitations have been exposed by Iraq, whose economic strength is now being challenged by China, and whose exemplary model has been tarnished by some of our responses to 9/11. But I also believe that if America does not lead, more often than not, progress will not be made in the world. And the world looks to us for leadership in practically everything. A few years ago, I walked into the office of the National Security Advisor, and on his desk was a stack of files, maybe this high, 25, 30 files. I said, "What are those files?" He said, "Every one of those files demands immediate attention." And there was another stack of files over here, and I said, "How about that stack?" There were 25 or 30 or 50 files there. He said, "Those are all urgent." Every problem in the world comes to the White House. You and I hear about a lot of them, not all of them, but every country in the world wants us to lead, and every visitor to Washington every day, we have a foreign minister, or a prime minister, or a king, or some high-ranking official, and they all come to Washington for one reason. They want help. Maybe they want money, maybe they want military equipment, maybe they want trade, maybe they want economic aid, maybe they want a picture op with the president. But they come to Washington seeking help because they believe still that American leadership is essential. And what I think Americans want is a leadership on behalf of a world where our interests are protected, where we work with like-minded nations, and where the values of liberty and justice and opportunity are the norm and not the exception, and where, if I may use the phrase of Martin Luther King, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. And so how do you apply American power? Let me give you some personal feelings as to how I think we should apply power after Iraq. I hope we're less likely to divide up the world between good and evil, but recognize that there are a variety of interests and motivations and nuances and shades of gray. I hope we'll have a deeper sense of the limits of our own power, of what we can achieve by ourselves alone in the world. I hope we'll make a better, stronger effort to forge consensus on the use of force domestically and internationally. I hope we'll be concerned about this word legitimacy. Most Americans don't pay much attention to it, but it's hugely important in international relations that whatever we do be seen to be legitimate. I hope we'll have a greater appreciation of our allies and of international institutions. I hope we'll turn increasingly to diplomacy, rejecting the view that talking to our adversaries by itself is a concession. I've often seen the United States withdraw an ambassador when we run into a problem with a country. That's exactly the wrong time to withdraw an ambassador, when you got a problem. I don't know how you solve problems in the world without talking to people. If you know how to do it, let me know. That doesn't mean talking always works. It obviously does not. But let me tell you another story. I was in the Congress when we began to have conversations with the members of the Parliament of the Soviet Union, the Supreme Soviet. And Jim, I remember those meetings. I would come in and I'd read a speech, and my counterpart in the Soviet Union would get up and read a speech. And after we had read the speeches, we'd toast each other with vodka and say we were for peace in the world and prosperity for our children and grandchildren, and then we'd go home. And then we did it the next year. And the next year. And the next year. And then something began to happen. And what began to happen was we put away the set speeches and we began to talk to one another. Took a long time. Took decades. The problems between us were immense. But you know what? In all of those decades, not a single shot was fired. Not a single soldier died in that conflict. And when Ronald Reagan went to Berlin and said, "Tear down this wall," that very week, he sent an emissary to Moscow to negotiate an arms control treaty. I hope we'll learn the value of diplomacy. I hope we'll become more pragmatic and less ideological in our policies and ask ourselves, as most Americans do, what works? Not what do I think as a Democrat or you think as a Republican? Not the liberal solution or the conservative solution, but what works? What's pragmatic? That's the way the American people are, I believe. And I think American foreign policy ought to be pragmatic as well. I hope we'll be less willing to try to shape other nations to fit our mold and more willing to focus on our national interests and, of course, our own security. And I hope we'll be able to understand how hard it is to achieve grand transformation in the world. I'm not at all sure we've got the will or the resources to sustain that kind of an effort. And I hope we'll see better balance of power between the Congress of the United States and the President. A member of Congress takes an oath of office. "I swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States." You don't swear to uphold and defend the President of the United States. You don't swear to uphold and defend your constituents. You don't swear to uphold and defend your largest campaign contributor. You swear to uphold and defend the Constitution, and if the Constitution means anything at all, it means a separation of powers, an independent, separate, strong, robust Congress. And I believe the founding fathers of this nation wanted both a robust and strong president and also a robust and strong Congress. And out of the tension between these two institutions, the conflict, if you will, would emerge better policy. And I want to see us return to that. Now, you're going to be very glad to hear that I'm not going to analyze all the foreign policy problems that we've got in this country today. And I should begin to wrap up here. I don't think I will, but I should begin to. I've got an awful lot to say, and there's no clock ticking. I don't have a 5-minute rule here, Jim. I can just go on. I don't mind this fellow in the middle of the room looking at his watch, but when he looks at it and starts shaking it, I do get a little unhappy with him. I want to say just a word or two about this pragmatic idea I mentioned a moment ago. You know, American foreign policy decisions basically are made by very few people. The really tough decisions are made by the President of the United States. But the burden of those decisions fall upon ordinary Americans. The soldiers in Iraq. The person walking to work on that day of 9/11, the taxpayer. So I want to see American foreign policy more pragmatic and more willing to take into account how much it's going to cost us in terms of resources to get the goals that we want. You remember John F. Kennedy talking about bear any burden? No, you don't. You're too young. Some of us who are older remember it, bear any burden in defense of liberty. I can remember being thrilled with that, but it's just totally flat out off the charts. We can't do that, my friends. We cannot do it. We have to pick and choose. When the president says we're going to end tyranny, it's a wonderful goal. Do you think we can do it? Do you think we can end tyranny in the world? No, we can't. Not at a price we're willing to pay. I think there has to be this element of pragmatism come into our thinking, and we have to be willing to settle for a little less than perfection. We have to see a stable society instead of a model democracy. We have to support political, pragmatic reform that extends rights and privileges to more citizens, not an immediate transformation of a society. In short, we have to settle for progress rather than for perfection. And we became the most powerful nation in the world, not because of the strength of our arms, not because of the money in our banks, but because America served as a beacon of hope and opportunity. And one of the big problems that worries me today is the radicalization of Islam. If you're going to win the war on terror, you got to go after Osama bin Laden. I acknowledge that. But you've also got to deal with 1.3 billion Muslims from London to Jakarta. Young people, most of them. The population of Iran is 50% under 30 years of age. And it worries me that the United States, with all of its ideals and its compassion and its sensitivity to human suffering, is losing the battle. Have you seen the ratings of how the United States compares to other countries and country after country after country in the world? Doesn't it bother you? Doesn't it bother you when you pick up a poll and see that Osama bin Laden is admired more than the President of the United States in many countries? How can that be? How can it be? Somehow we are not able to get across these values. Let me tell you a story. This is a politician's story, but I think it has relevance to foreign policy. Every single politician I know in elected office is asked by a constituent from time to time to do something that is utterly impossible to do. The politician who succeeds does not say to that constituent, "I cannot help you." You know what they say? In the words of another politician, "I feel your pain." Or, "I'm on your side." Now, the analogy may be a little simplistic, but I don't think it is. And what we in the United States have to say to these 1.3 billions is, look, we can't solve all your problems for you. We're not smart enough. We're not rich enough. But believe you me, we want for you the same things we want for ourselves. We want a decent life. We want a good education. We want good health care. We want a decent retirement. We want a good job. We want to have freedom. We want to be able to marry the person of our choice. Your countries have been repressive and they've stopped you from doing these things, but we're on your side. We can't transform the world, but we want you to know that in your quest for human dignity, we're on your side. And we take certain steps to try to achieve that. And so we have a $40 or $50 million program that says to the Pakistanis, we're going to set up and support secular schools of education rather than the madrasa school, which teaches hatred of you and me and hatred of America. We're going to support secular education. A lot of people don't like that program. They say it's wasting a lot of money. I disagree with it because I think it sends the right signal. We're on your side. We want to try to help you improve your education. We can't do it ourselves. You've got to do it, but we can help. That's what I mean by pragmatism. America has been the most powerful nation in the world because of the strength of our ideals and our conveyance of hope and opportunity for the world. When this country was founded, it sparked a new era and a new kind of government, representative government. And when we opened our doors wide to the immigrants in the 19th century, We became a country, a designation of hope for people around the world. And when we stood up to the Soviets in the Cold War, there was little doubt on which side of the Iron Curtain most of the world wanted to live on. And that is the power of example and the power of persuasion. And we have to have, of course, and I really will begin to conclude now. I know you're very grateful for that, concluding. We really do have to have a strong base at home to carry out our foreign policy. If our economic growth is robust, it encourages other nations to adopt market economies. If we are less dependent on oil and gas from foreign countries, we would not be so tied to events in the Middle East. If we did not have a substantial trade deficit with countries like China, we would have more freedom of action in our economic affairs. If we were more united at home and less polarized and split by partisan divisions as a country, we would be more able to tackle the tough global challenges that we have. The final point I want to make is this, that I think top policymakers in the United States government over a period of years, I'm not just talking about the present leadership, have been too dismissive of the views of the American people. There is a powerful strain of elitism in American foreign policy. A feeling by policymakers that the American people are not well informed enough on complex matters, that they are not able to master the subject matter of foreign affairs, that they are guided by passion and not intellect, and that the country is better served by leaving such serious matters to the elites. If I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times. Trust me. Or if you've only seen the intelligence that I have seen, you know what I think? I think we need to pay more attention to the Psalms, to the admonition of the Bible. Put not your faith in princes. Take a look at the polls today. What do they say? I picked up a poll a week or 10 days ago. First, the people want us to disengage from Iraq responsibly. Second, the people want us to take out Osama bin Laden and other known terrorists. Third, the people want us to engage in diplomacy with our adversaries, not just our friends. Fourth, the people want us to reduce our dependence on oil. Fifth, the people want us to maintain strong alliances. You know what that means? That comes across to me as pretty good sense. In Indiana, we'd call it a down-home judgment. I don't know what you call it in Texas. Now look, I don't romanticize that the people are always right, but I do suggest that the policymaker sometimes needs a harness, and they need to think about who bears the burden of the decisions that they make. The burden's on ordinary people. And to succeed, U.S. foreign policy must have a sensitive ear, always respectfully tuned to the voice of the American people. A voice often has the pragmatism that we need in our policies. So, my friends, America cannot shrink from our global leadership. I don't for a moment buy into this idea of a decline in this country. We must lead our people and our interests and protect our interests. But surely we understand now that we cannot dictate our terms to the world. Surely we understand now that there are limitations to our power. Surely we understand now that we have to avoid the temptation of being infatuated with every foreign adventure. Surely we understand that we have to seek consensual solutions. We can't bear all the burdens by ourselves. Surely we understand that we have to be sensitive to the human condition in the world and the universal quest for human dignity. And instead of merely seeking confrontation with those who oppose us, we should push relentlessly for opportunities for all who are willing to join us. And instead of thinking that peace and security can come through military action alone or diplomatic action alone, it takes all kinds of actions. We must know that peace and security will come through the integrated, skillful, and prudent use of all of the tools of American power, military and diplomatic and economic and political. Instead of trying to tackle all of the problems by ourselves, we should share the burdens with others who seek a world order that is peaceful and just. I think that's a realistic and balanced view of American foreign policy. And I'm very, very pleased that I've had a chance to be with you tonight. Thank you.